Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hello, Santa Barbara. Welcome to Community Alert on Christmas Eve, 2013. Today we're going to do something a little different. Christmas Major, The Fire Horse Who Saved Christmas, book written by David Hubert and Barbara Hubert. Fascinating story, not only about the story itself, but the sub-story as well as the history of the California Fire Service. Interviewed the Huberts a couple of months ago down in their Orange County home, and we're going to play it for you now, and we'll be back in a half an hour and pick it up from there. Richard, go ahead. Hello, welcome back. We're talking today about Christmas Major, The Fire Horse Who Saved Christmas, with Dave and Barbara Hubert.
It's been quite an experience, you know. After I spent about 31 years with the fire service, and for the last 14 years, Barbara and I have been traveling throughout California with this great old steam fire engine, and about 50% of the times this fire engine is pulled with horses, and after averaging about 50 shows a year for the past 14 years. With all that experience, we got together, matter of fact, after we saw the movie War Horse, and we talked together about, golly, you know, we've got a story about a horse that's probably just as good as War Horse. So I sat down one day and typed out this story, and lo and behold, it's a fictional story, but it's based on facts and truths and realities of life, and my childhood had a lot to do with it. I was raised in Connecticut, and at an early age, my father took me to the Hartford Fire Department, and I met an old fire captain there that showed me throughout the fire station where the horses were and the slide pole, and believe it or not, this guy really inspired me. And on the same day, I remember seeing the Hartford Orphanage, which was just down the street from the Hartford Fire Department. And both buildings looked the same, and it was very interesting to me. Here's a service-oriented building, and then here's another service-oriented building, but with a total different atmosphere. And I always felt sad for those orphans in that orphanage. And one interesting thing about it is my dad always threatened to take me to the orphanage if I didn't behave.
Well, Barbara, you were also instrumental in the writing of the book. What's your contribution to the story?
Well, yes, I was instrumental. However, Dave sincerely sat down and wrote the entire story all by himself. I'll never forget it, because I'd look over and he'd be inputting away on the computer. And when he had the entire storyline done, he handed it to me to read, because traditionally my role will be to help him with the administrative factions, such as proofreading and correcting and perhaps
spelling.
Perhaps suggesting some structural reorganization. So I remember vividly sitting down at my computer after he sent me a copy, and I went through the entire story, and I couldn't even leave. I was spellbound by how interesting it was, and quite frankly, very pleasantly surprised. So we chatted quite a bit about the storyline, which never had to change in any way, but each of us felt we had to embellish it a little more, mm-hmm. because it needed some additional color. And of course, we always knew that we were fortunate enough that Dave was going to be able to illustrate the whole book, which is certainly a plus. So my role was basically reviewing and doing all of the corrections and the proofreading, but I just fell in love with it right off the bat.
Now, admittedly, I am not an academic genius, but I have some traits from my father, who was as good as Norman Rockwell when it came to illustrations. And my father always had a knack to tell a story. He would keep my brother and I in stitches, and he would keep our interest as young children. As, of course, I grew up in the late 40s and early 50s, and I remember to this day the stories my dad would tell me, and his richness and the texture of the stories that kept one held to the storyline. I don't have an academic ability, with regard to pronunciation and paragraph construction, but I can sure come up with a wild story here and there.
Well, but that's a good thing, because we all have prefab books that fit models and molds that the publishers want us to write. This follows a whole different format. This is much more written as people talk, not necessarily the way people read, and it makes for the story environment. I can see people sitting around and actually reading this in open form.
Barb and I go to movies a lot. It's difficult to get to an uncomplicated, happy movie anymore. You know, you have these mechanical monsters and these aliens all over the theater. And so what I like about the book, it's from the heart. It talks about the realities of life, talks about the texture of romance, and it talks about the relationships between animals and people. And after I did my research about the early fire service and reading some of the great stories about the fire horse, for instance, Farewell, Good and Faithful Servants, a story about the San Francisco fire horses that was unpublished and is kept at the San Francisco Museum. This document was so full of interesting anecdotes about the fire horse of yesterday that I just had to do something. And of course, in our Barber and Ice profession now of doing parades and public displays throughout California, we have a horse team that pulls for us. Matter of fact, we have four horse teams that pull for us. And to see how the horse people work, to see how things are done, I can just imagine in the early days how rewarding this must have been for these firemen to have these animals with them in the fire stations.
Part of the story that I found fascinating was particularly in Chapter 2, about the history of the fire service all the way back to when it was done by hand, literally, up to the steamer age, and the number of people that were required and the commitment that a community had to have towards their fire service. And it wasn't so much about prevention as it was the mechanics of actually being able to put fires out. What were causing the fires of the day? I don't think people today understand the fire dangers that existed 100 years ago.
You're right on, Michael. In fact, that was one of my first impressions when I read the book is, not only was it a fun story, but the history that one learns in this, I think the average person wouldn't know most of the things that Dave covered in the book. And you hit on one of them, which is the very, very early towns. Well, first of all, they were all wooden. Everything was constructed of wood. And then, heaven forbid, candles were used throughout for all types of lighting, even decorations, as many of the audience might know. They even put candles on the Christmas trees. So I'm afraid it was an accident waiting to happen in almost every household because of the use of the open flames and the construction of the early towns.
Yeah, if you were to look back at our nation's history, every, and I mean that literally, every major city and town in the United States burned down to the ground once or twice in its early existence. Like Barbara says, everything was made out of wood. They were built close together. Open flames were used for everything, heating, lighting, and cooking. Much to our astonishment, they used open flame candles on Christmas trees. Mm-hmm. And the fireplaces, at times, were made of wood with baked-on mud on the inside to keep the wood from burning. And then in the early days, there were no water systems. They really didn't have good hoses. And it took, on an average, 30 to 50 guys to get a hand pumper wagon from the fire station. Matter of fact, there's an interesting anecdote here. If you were to ask today's firemen why there's a red light in front of a fire station, very few of them really know. But my research and my time with the steamer, I was able to find the answer why there is a red light in front of a fire station. In the early days, the lamplighter in the cities would paint the lamp in front of the barn where they kept the firefighting tools. They would paint that lamp red. And that tradition has carried over to today, and it simply means here's the fire equipment. So there's a piece of history. After being a firefighter for 31 years, I never really knew about that, but this research and this experience with this steam engine helped me out.
Well, in some communities, all men were required to be able to be firefighters. That was expected of them. That's how the community supported the fire service, and the red lights were something you were to look for if you were in an unfamiliar town, so that if something were to occur, you'd know where your equipment was.
You're right. Everyone in the community was required, at least in Philadelphia. I remember reading this in Philadelphia in the late 1700s. Every household was required to have a fire bucket. And then the ladders and the thatching hooks, which they pulled the roofs off of houses, and the pumper was kept down the street, in literally just in a little shed, and that was marked by the red street lamp. And the lamplighter, after he would light the streetlights at night, would go into his tower, and he'd watch the city for streets, for fires. And when the fire occurred, he would simply ring the big bell, and everyone at night would turn out with their buckets. Here comes the word turnout gear. So they'd turn out at night, go to the firehouse, which was marked by the red light, pick up the hand pumper, and it took literally 10 to 20 guys to pull this hand pumper. And they were cobblestone streets. There were a lot of hills in the community. And boy, by the time they got to the fire, these people were pretty wrung out. And then they had to leave the wagon, then they had to start pumping. I don't know if you've ever pumped a hand pumper. I have at one of the musters, and I tell you, I could only do it for about 5 to 8 minutes. And then, of course, you have to be relieved, and you go take a few minutes off, and the 8 minutes it takes to get the rest, you got to go replace that guy up there. So it was really, the fire departments of yesterday needed a lot of manpower, and that's a good explanation why the horses came along.
Well, they also went to a lot of fires. It was not unusual to go to 2, 3, 4 fires a day.
Correct. I remember reading during the summertime, it wasn't so bad. But during the wintertime, they had fires every other night, every night. And, of course, everyone had to heat their homes. And that was a great cause for the fires. But also in the wintertime, you had snow to contend with. You had rain to contend with. And, boy, that added to the burden of the poor firefighters.
Well, as we move into the book itself, you have a tremendous introduction. That's a story unto itself. Can you elaborate on that a little bit before we get into the story?
This story that he's talking about is when we first got the steamer, clear back in 1999. We were invited to a parade out in a central California city, and we went there to do this parade. This is a heartbreaking story. And every time I talk about it, I tear up. It's true to the fact. It's quite emotional. Anyway, we went to this parade. We got there early, and because we were there early, it was a Saturday parade, and we staged there Friday afternoon. And we were staged in a hospital parking lot. And the people from the hospital, it happened to be a hospital for terminally ill children, and they came over and were talking to us. And when they saw the horses and the rich fire wagons and our uniforms, and we told them what we were there for, they asked if we wouldn't mind showing the horses to the terminally ill children. And of course, we agreed, and we got all dressed up, and we made arrangements to go in an arcade. The hospital staff was going to bring the children down in their hospital beds. They're going to be in a big arcade-like area, about 80 feet by, I guess it was about 80 feet by 100 feet. It was all brick. And so we agreed to do this about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And a guy by the name of Jimmy Glenn, which was the horse guy, and I, we went over and looked at the patio area. And it was very slick. And our horses, of course, they're draft horses, and they're very heavy horses, and they have steel shoes on. And they would have slipped on this footing. So we just so happened to have a pair of parade shoes, booties that you put over the horse's hooves. And while we were waiting to go for our 4 o'clock stage time, I was sitting there drinking a lemonade with all the rest of the guys, and I drew the Nike symbol on one of these booties. And the horse that we took into this patio area was named Major. Now, this is a big Percheron draft horse of about 2,000 pounds and 18 hands high. 18 hands means how high the horse is. You measure from the shoulders or the withers clear down to his hoof. This is a big horse. He had about a 10-inch hoof on him to show you how big he was. So we put these booties on him, and we all dressed up in our uniforms, and we walked into this patio arcade-like area. And as we walked in, there were 6 beds with children in those beds, elevated, of course, so they could see us come in. And they were all wired up to IVs and monitors. And as we walked in with this big, massive white Percheron by name of Major, we were all worried about what they traditionally do, go to the bathroom, and we were all worried that he would do that, but he didn't. And we walked in there, and you should have heard the children gasp and smile, and wow! Is that a real horse? And then one of the children said, look, the horse has on Nike tennis shoes. And they clued in on this Nike logo that we had on. And it was everyone chuckled and everyone laughed. So there happened to be 6 beds, and it happened to be 6 firemen there. So each one of us firemen, we all had our parade uniforms on. We went over and we picked a child each and we talked to them. And then Jimmy took the horse around to each bed, and he brought Major up to, and the children got to pet the horse's nose, and he went from bed to bed. And you could see that Major this horse knew exactly what to do, and he knew the reason he was there. I swear I saw the horse smile. It was that emotional to see what was happening. When he got to me, and I was with a little guy by name of Jason. Jason was 8 years old, and he had spent 7 of his years in that hospital with a terminal illness. And as a matter of fact, he told me that he was going to die soon. I still have trouble with that today, thinking about that statement. By the time Major came over to Jason, Jason reached up and he petted Major's head and his nose. Of course, if you ever petted a nose of a horse, you know it feels just like velvet. And Major just kind of curled up his lip and gave him a smile. And little Jason said, "Fireman Dave, could I ride Major?" He caught me completely off guard. He just said, you know, and without thinking or without checking with any of the doctors, I said, "Sure." And so we grabbed his IVs and his monitors, and we simply just lifted the poor kid up on the back of Major, and we walked him around the patio. And this was quite a sight. As we finished our walk around the patio, he says, "Fireman Dave, I want to drive Major." And without hesitation, Jimmy, who was leading the horse with the reins, calmly gave the reins to Jason. Of course, Jimmy held the bridle in his hand as we walked again around the patio. And of course, after we finished that second walk around, every child wanted to ride Major. So that day, that Friday afternoon, Major and his firemen were lucky enough to give 6 wonderful children a wonderful ride. And of course, you look back at it today and you know that all those have passed on. And ironically, last year, our beloved Major passed on. And they're all up in heaven now with one another.
With that, we kind of get into the book. And I thought I'd just start with the first chapter. That icy winter of 1890 brought another dark, snowy night to the city of Markford, Connecticut. Just a faint outline of the old, faded brick building known as the City of Markford Children's Orphanage could be seen through the heavy, white snow as it fell silently towards the frosty Christmas Eve. Even with the dim wall lantern illuminating the growing snowdrifts and frigid winter air, tonight the orphanage seemed somehow even colder than ever. That's a great opening paragraph to a long book. That in itself must have a bit of a story behind it, but that is the foundation in which this book is written. Tell us about it.
Well, and I have to tell you, Michael, that's my favorite part of the book is the opening chapter. I think part of it is that Dave and I both had the privilege of living back there in the East. We both lived in Connecticut at some time. And the picture that Dave painted with those words and also the illustration in the book just reminds me of being back in our childhood. But I just think that that opening sets the stage for everything. That poor little baby is on the doorstep with almost no future, as it were. So that's my favorite part, too.
Well, the story talks about Nick. Nick is our central figure in the book. How did Nick come to be? Who is Nick?
Well, Nicholas Holliday. They found him on Christmas Eve in 1890. And, of course, the staff, you know, here was this little baby in a basket on the porch of the orphanage. And so the orphanage staff had the right to bring him in, care for him. And they named him Nicholas Holliday because, you know, Christmas time. It's a wonderful story about this orphan who grows up there. And he really has less of everything. When you look at today, what we have today, and what they had in those poor towns of the 1890s, it makes one really appreciate how far we've come with care for our children and education for our children. And the Markford Fire Department, like I said, when I visited the Hartford Fire Department, I remember the old fire captain telling me about how they used to care for the children and help the staff at the orphanage. The Christmases were kind of sponsored by the firemen who would get toys from the community and rebuild the toys, and they'd clean the clothing for the children, and they would always have a big party for the orphanage at Christmas time. And everyone in town knew that the Christmas for the orphans came from the firemen of Hartford. And there's a lot of richness to that. And that's, you know, that's a true element of this fictional book. Of course, the story about Nicholas Holliday, who, by the way, is an African-American. And he went to work for the fire department around the early 1900s. And in my research, I find that Hartford's first African-American firefighter actually went to work for Hartford in 1903.
Well, there's a great sub-story going on with Dick. Not only is he an orphan, not only does he grow up, not only does he befriend the fire service, but he also falls in love with May, which is a story that kind of parallels all this. And it's sort of a courtship that you don't see today, because everything today happens so quickly. But back then, things didn't happen that fast, and the ability for people to come together was not as easy as it is today. And the hardships that both of these two people went through, and the story that they have going on at the same time. This is a remarkably complex story, even though it is on such a simple premise.
Okay, Michael, I don't want to go any further because I'll give this great story away, but let's just suffice it to say that we have a big drama on our hands because we're about to disappoint every single child in this orphanage without some kind of a resolution. So you'll just have to read the book to find out the magic that happens. For a minute, I just want to remind our audience that, by golly, this entire story, as wonderful as it is not all for the gentlemen in the audience. There's some girl stuff in here, too, and that's perhaps where my role came in. I want to share with you one little anecdote that I just think is pretty special. May, who is the main character in the book, we talked about her before, the main female character, and the one that Nick falls in love with, had a beautiful story of when she was a little child, and it goes like this. Her mother was an excellent seamstress, and she used to embroider, as all the ladies did back then, beautiful little flowers and everything on all of her garments. And one day, May looked down on her pinafore, and she looked at her pocket at this new pinafore that her mom had done for her, and she's looking at it, and she can't figure out why. She's looking at all this embroidery, and she says, "My gosh, it's like chicken scratches. What happened to Mom? Why did she do that?" And she went to her mom. She said, "Mom, what's the matter with my pocket?" And her mom said, "Now, child," she said, "you just open that pocket and you look inside." And May pulls the pocket open, and inside is a perfectly beautiful set of embroidered flowers. And her mom said, "Now, you see," and I'm not quoting directly, but her mom wanted to teach her that to look inside for beauty, that beauty wasn't always what you saw outside. So that's some of the girl stuff that was sprinkled into the book that I think the ladies will enjoy and the young children. And we threw a wedding in there too.
Yes, and they planned for the wedding and they talk about the planning of the wedding. One other thing I wanted to share with our listeners is that you also did all the art in this book, and you're well known in the California Fire Service as a well-known cartoonist, but your artwork in here is a completely different theme. What inspired you to draw these plates?
Well, Barbara and I are fortunate enough to own a functional steam fire engine, so I had the engine to use as a reference to make everything correct. And as a cartoonist, things don't have to be correct. But I decided in the illustrations on this book that I didn't want to make them cartoonish. I wanted to make them somewhat antique-ish, and I wanted to make them realistic. I wanted to keep them light and uncomplicated. They're color watercolor drawing, and so I tried to stick with an old-style illustration element in this book, and that's kind of where it came from. I wanted it serious, but I wanted it lighthearted, and I wanted it to convey a message. And yet most people know me as Hubie, and I'm the cartoonist, and I have been in a lot of trouble for making from enhancing too many cartoons with big stomachs and big noses, and I've gotten trouble for that. And of course there's always the politically incorrect cartoons that I get chewed out for, but it all in all, it's a fun profession to be in, a retired firefighter, and I know the profession, and I know its character, and I enjoy drawing about it and writing about it.
Well, Christmas Major, the fire horse who saved Christmas, the heartwarming story tells about an abandoned orphan and the spirited draft horses coming together to save lives and care for others. Available at HubiePictures.com, as is Dave's other book, Hubie and the Fire Service, as well as a video, The Steamer of the American Icon, all available at HubiePictures.com. Christmas Major also available at Amazon.com and selected Costco's and eBay. Absolutely, you can get it through eBay. But if you have any questions on how to get your copy, visit www.HubiePictures.com. Dave, Barbara, Blaze, Dottie, what a crew we've had here today. This has been fun meeting with you guys and talking to you about what is a terrific personal achievement.
Well, thank you, Mike, and thank your staff. We truly appreciate talking about Christmas Major.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Hey, folks, this is Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My coach is Mike Williams. Merry Christmas, Mike.
Yeah, thank you.
It's just Mike and I today, and
Well, we just finished with the Dave and Barbara Hubert interview. That was fun. We'll run a commercial here before the end of the show on how you can get a copy of Christmas Major if you're interested. I want to thank them for taking time out to visit with us a couple months ago to make that happen.
Very good.
A fun book. On a programming note, next week I'm going to be in Vermont and you're going to be wherever. And so we're going to repeat our December 10th show on diabetes. It was an important show. We had a lot of folks in here from Department of Public Health. And while it may not be a holiday theme, it's important because we know people are going to be home. We're going to replay that. So,
well,
again,
now that I've been diagnosed with the possibility, I'm going to listen to the show, you know, and find out what it's all about.
I'm sorry to hear that. But December 10th will be replayed next Tuesday at this time.
That'll be New Year's Eve.
Yeah, which is, diabetes and alcohol. Sugar,
I guess, you know. Wow.
So, but in any event, that is the programming note. And like I said, I'm going to be in Vermont where it is currently looking like -6 on the evening temperature.
Really?
-4, you know, unlike our Santa Barbara weather. So I'm looking forward to that. Going to make a quick drop down into Boston for a day and take care of some things down there and then go back on up. So looking forward to some cold weather.
Yes. Well, it's a...
You grew up there, though, for
a period. Well, I did. But, you know, the weather's so glorious right now. It's unbelievable. Here's the third day of winter, fourth day of winter, whatever. And I mean, it's hot. We're out there in the sun going, wow. And the mountain is hot. And it's this morning you can see Catalina looking out just beautifully. It's so clear. Look down the coast to the east, and Catalina was just riding right out there. And... yeah, beautiful Santa Barbara.
As long as we're talking about good things and not doom and gloom, I should point out California Fire Safe Council, our sponsor, just renewed our grant for another couple of years. So we're going to be on the air for at least 2 more years.
Look out,
closer
folks,
to 3.
Here we come. Yeah.
So we're grateful for that. Got some paperwork to get into the folks in Sacramento before the end of January, but that came through, so that's good.
That's outstanding.
We should thank the folks that helped make that happen because that's a statewide effort, and it's kind of an acknowledgement of what we've been doing.
Yeah.
We're also going to be live at the California Public Information Officers Association conference in April, which is going to be held at the Fess Parker Red Lion. So
Wow. We're
going to be there for that on live. So we'll have some.
Are we going to broadcast from down there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Outstanding. That'll be fun.
Live and in color from Fess Parker, another remote. So be testing our ability to do that. So that's kind of fun. And we just had a breakfast planning meeting for EPIC, PIO group. What we're going to be doing next year, 2014, the year of training. So we're going to be pushing that.
Ah, very good.
People dialed in for that. Sure. So lots to talk about for next year.
Absolutely.
Lots of changes coming down the pike in the fire service. So,
well, you know, we keep hearing that, but everything seems to just kind of coast along, you know. I mean, we've been anticipating big changes.
Put your seatbelt on. It's coming.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's the silence before the storm. So a lot of interesting challenges starting to present themselves because of how we've been doing business for the last 30 years, 40 years, has now come home to roost.
Are these going to be like economic changes, structure in economics,
the whole process is going to change a lot out of necessity. And the retirement system is causing some interesting problems, not just in the fire service, but with public administrators, in general, because of PERS and your inability to continue to stay in the PERS system. So that's
PERS,
Public Employee Retirement System.
Good.
So what's happening is that fire chiefs, police chiefs, department heads, transportation, park, all those kinds of folks that are in PERS, we're having to hire people from out of California and bring them into California to take these jobs, which is kind of an interesting little challenge because mm-hmm. California is really way ahead of a lot of these states in many, many different ways. So we're looking at mandatory.
Well, why is it now we're having to go out to hire people? What is it?
People don't want to take on these heavy jobs because of their retirement system. They can't stay in a position when they're in a retirement system. When they retire, they can't come back.
I see.
So that's changed the game. So they're having to go outside, which has a lot of pros and cons to it, but it mm-hmm. changes the dynamics. And California's push to get involved with NFPA on an official formal standard is changing some things, if in fact that actually occurs.
So let me go back up. Let me back up a minute. That's an interesting point. Does that mean if you retire from one agency, you can't go to another agency and go to work for them in a similar capacity?
If the retirement system's the same. So that causes problem. Now you can go from, say, a PERS department, pick anyone you want, and you could go work for the University of California Fire Department or Police Department or something, because they have their own retirement system. You could work for one of the tribal government organizations. You could work for private. That's not. So there are opportunities out there, to be sure.
But it restricts the opportunities, obviously, because the market gets much.
So you got a guy or gal that's got 30 years of solid background education experience and what have you, and we're going to be losing some of those folks. And so the consequences of a lot of what we're reading about in the paper, pros and cons, is changing the game plan. EMS is another thing that's going to change a lot of the way things happen. So with that, we're going to be up to our next break here. Community Alert, not HIPAA Win, Positive Preparation for Disaster, sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council, Fire Services Training Institute, on KZSB AM 1290, live at newspress.com. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, folks, to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. It's just Ted and Mike today, wishing you all a Merry Christmas. Be safe and sane. And Mike.
Well, we should take a moment here. We've had an interesting year. We were just talking during the break about your next article and the fact that there really hasn't been anything significant to occur this year, not in comparison to the previous years. We haven't had that major earthquake, and there hasn't been any significant collisions and disasters.
And no fire. Look out this next year. You know, we'll probably double up on everything.
Well, you know, we can look at this many different ways. One of them is that prevention is working, that public education awareness is working, that people are paying more attention than they were in the past, that fire prevention techniques are starting to take hold. The small fires that have occurred in Santa Barbara, the city and county, CAL FIRE, Forest Service, they all responded promptly, quickly, and aggressively, and because of prep work that had been done in advance, we're able to get these things under control. I mean, there's all kinds of positives that we can put to that.
I don't want to write anything positive, though, you know.
You're going to ruin your image, especially with that hat. But you do look like Dr. Seuss here today. But so I think the lack of things that have happened, actually throughout the state, this has been a fairly quiet year, despite the fact that all the formula was lining up to having a disastrous fire season.
Yeah.
The unseen thing, kind of like high blood pressure and diabetes, is the water drought that we have in California.
Well, we could still have a major fire because we just don't have the water in the
exactly. Richard,
do you have the stats at all of the number of fires that have broken out over 2013? And again, this goes to what you were just saying about how they've been jumping on them aggressively, the prevention and so on and so forth. But I mean, compared to previous years where we had the big fires,
right?
Okay. How many fires have we had in 2013 in the state of California or in the Central Coast?
Well, that information is readily available. I don't have it here right at the moment, but it's available on the Internet.
You think it's comparable
to
previous years?
I'd have to look. The fire history in the United States continues to decline at about 45 degrees. There's a couple of little small blips in there, but for the most part, it continues to decline. However, when you break that out into individual incidents, structure fires, dumpster fires, car fires, and what have you, there's various fluctuations on different types of things. Structure fires in some areas are actually increasing, and we can speculate as to why that may be, because most of them are vacant buildings. I was just up in Plumas County two weekends ago. There were two massive structure fires up there, one in an abandoned hotel, and the other, they burned down an entire block in Quincy. Fire started in the pizza, Karen. And this is a county that's protected almost exclusively by volunteer fire departments. So, and it was an amazing save. And they were working in temperatures in the low sixes, 5-4 degrees and what have you in the middle of the night with snow-covered ground. Not the kind of environment that we have down here in Santa Barbara.
Right.
So they are happening. They do occur. I can get that information, and that might be something that Ted could write about, too, as we can pull up those stats.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, it's continuing to decline. The issue, though, for the fire service, of course, is emergency medical services and the ever-expanding birth that's bringing with us. We'll talk about that a little bit when we come back on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Live on the Internet at newspress.com. I want to thank all those out there on the Internet listening to us today. KZSB AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio. We'll be right back.
folks. Welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My coach is Mike Williams. It's just Ted and Mike today. I'm doing a little Christmas Eve program. Wishing you all the best. Safe and sane. Mike.
Well, programming note, next Tuesday, December 10th show will repeat. This is the Public Health Department's review of diabetes and how important it is for us to get a handle on that and what you can do about diabetes, what's happening here in the county, different types of programs that are available. Not very holiday spirited, no, admittedly, but a very important topic, and we want to take the opportunity to rebroadcast that. It's a timely show. It was very well done. Lots of good information in it. December 10th, this time next week.
I'd actually say that it's probably very timely in the sense that I associate, when I hear about diabetes, and of course you have to take insulin in some cases, and it has a lot to do with your sugar levels, and I associate it with the holidays, with consuming all of those rich foods, the sweets, the sugars, all of that kind of stuff. I don't have to go back and
listen
to the
program. Well, what I learned that was interesting, I thought that diabetes was all about a malfunction of the pancreatic area that puts out insulin, but evidently that's not the case. That's type 1 diabetes, which is a little more serious than the type 2, which is the most prevalent type, and that is when your blood cells are rejecting glucose for some reason. And that's why the high level of glucose in the system, because your cells are not assimilating the glucose and burning it up, and that's why you're tired and you sleep a lot and you feel lethargic, and you end up getting, you know, your extremities start getting pins and needles and all that sort of thing. And it's not because of a lack of insulin, it's the inability for the cells to take up the glucose
to
that's in the system
it,
and process it, which is, but I never knew that.
But glucose is still sugar. I mean,
there's lots of different. I mean, even milk has lactose, which is one of the sugars, and then there's fructose, and there's all these different sugars. And once you have that problem, you start paying attention to it all, which is looks like I'm on the program.
But at your recent Christmas party,
that's why I'm getting really interested in it all.
And add that with MRIs and everything else.
Oh my God! Yeah, like, the funny hat, everything.
Yeah, next year you're going to have lots of things to talk about.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You're going to be on the front
or
lines.
Maybe you'll be talking about me, and I won't be saying anything at all.
Well, take notes because.
anyway. Yeah.
Well, we have some folks to thank, and we need to thank folks because this doesn't just happen. And certainly the folks at the California Fire Safe Council, big supporters and sponsors, as well as the staff here at KZSB and Ampersand Broadcasting and the world-famous Les Carroll and Richard Dugan working our slide pots on a regular basis and keeping us on the clock. These are folks that help.
Barbara Anderson for her never-ending support and help with the
entire Orfila Foundation. Mm-hmm. The folks over at VOAD. Big supporters,
yep.
The EPIC group and all different agencies that participate in EPIC. We need to extend a thank you, too, to our friends over at Public Health, who are big advocates of our ability to get the word out for them. Santa Barbara County Fire, Santa Barbara City Fire, down at Carp Summerlin Fire. We had some fun earlier this year with them. Montecito, all these different agencies, Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department, all helping behind the scenes with us keeping a library of information available so that we can bring this forward to you guys.
They've been so helpful and responsive to us, too. You know, whenever we got any questions or when we need some advice or something about something that they have more technical knowledge of, they're always there to help us out.
Yeah, and this was an idea that came out of a simple conversation on the phone one day, and look where we are 5-plus years down the road.
Yeah, be careful what you say, folks, even on the phone.
Yeah, I get asked, how'd you end up in the broadcasting business? And I said, well, I was probably too stupid not to walk through the front door. So, this has been a great year for us. We've had a lot of great interviews, and I think all the way back to when I was at the Emergency Management Institute in Emmitsburg, we did live broadcasts from there. We've done several live for remotes. Certainly one we did with Hubert's was fun to do down in Orange County. We've learned a lot, and it's given us an opportunity to change our thoughts about a lot of things. You don't know what you don't know, and when you start talking to, in fact, ironically, I just ran into one of the chief officers from Sac Metro down here at the store during the break. You never know who you're going to run into. So with that, we're running into the clock on Community Alert, sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster on KZSB AM 1290. We'll be right back.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. Host is Mike Williams. And it's just Mike and Ted today wishing you Merry Christmas.
You know, talking about programming notes here, I'm working on the January program, and I've got a gentleman coming in that's one of the country's leading bagpipers, Robert Hagee. He's played all over the world, internationally recognized bagpiper, and we got to talking the history of the bagpipe and all of the aspects of this was fascinating, and I got into a conversation with him, well, how did the bagpipes get so ingrained into public safety? So he's going to come on and talk about that. We're going to have some clips of some of his music, and it's going to be kind of fun.
I was sitting here going, all right, I know bagpipers, and I'm aware of the bagpipe, but I'm sitting here trying to find the segue between bagpipes and positive preparedness.
We were waiting for the disaster, but I was prepared, and I had the answer. No, it's fascinating.
They're war pipes. I mean, the whole thing was piping the men into the battle.
There are various different type of bagpipes out there, and I didn't realize. I thought bagpipe was a bagpipe. Well, that's not the case.
No, it isn't.
And learning how to play them properly and what have you. This guy's a master piper, and it'll be fun. So we've got a little different off the beat type of thing. But
I'll bring my bagpipes in. I wonder what and to show them. That'd be good.
He can tune them for you.
Well, that's one of the problems with bagpipes is keeping them in tune. That's a challenge because as you play them, they fall out of tune, and as they heat up, and it's just a big challenge.
Of course, many people think they're out of tune all the time. You know?
Well, exactly. So in any event, so we're working on some different types of guests next year. I'm supposed to go back east again for another class, so I'm looking to get some of the other folks in the U.S. Fire Academy to join us. So that'll be kind of fun. But people that are interested in providing some names or some ideas of guests that you'd like to hear, we'd be happy to get it. You know how to get a hold of us here at 564-1290 and just leave a message with Richard on the phone, and we'll try to track these folks down.
Sure.
Lots of good possibilities. And
well, there's a lot of information out there that we haven't covered, although it's good, pretty narrow. I'd like to hear some from other people, you know, because we've covered a lot of information in the last 4 years.
Well, and I'll tell you, one of the guys that you had on, whose name I'm not recalling, but I remember the subject matter, and that was his book that he wrote about predicting or at least tracking when earthquakes happen.
Well, that was the teacher from Los Angeles.
That was fascinating that he went so far into the statistics to be able to start mapping what time of day, or was it like early morning, depending upon where the
evening,
moon was.
Well, yeah, the tides.
The tides. I mean,
the sun pull separates the formation apart so that the rocks will slip more readily. Wow.
We need to track him down. It'd be interesting to talk to him a year and a half later, probably 2 years actually, and say, how does your data now look now that you collected data, you came up with a theory, now that you've got 2 years ahead of you or behind
it'd
you
be
now?
Good follow up.
Yeah, it'd be kind of
fun. He said 50% at that time.
And I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't know.
But well, it's half full or half empty, you know, just
right. Right. So, well, one of these days it's going to happen. I was listening to a lecture by one of the ladies from MIT about earthquakes in Southern California, and one of the big issues that she brought up was utilities, that almost all the utilities cross the San Andreas Fault in Southern California. That's your gas, your waters, your power lines, all your IT stuff that's not microwave is going across on land. And because we live in an on-demand society now where nobody actually has anything, it comes from somewhere else.
Right.
Well, it's coming from somewhere else via the roads that go across there. So she was talking at great lengths about some of the ramifications of what a major earthquake would bring to Southern California that we're not necessarily thinking about because we focus on the damage and the injuries and all the trauma
and
drama.
You and I have talked about this before, but the whole idea that we're going to lose our gas because it gets pumped out of the ground, we're going to lose our cash because it comes out of the ATM machine, we're going to lose anything that has to do with cash registers, electronic movement, of course, not to mention the lights and the heating and all the other
things. We've been cheerful all the way to the last minute and a half of the show, and you're back into doom and gloom on Christmas Eve 2013. And with that, we want to thank all of our listeners for paying attention and listening to us this year. If you ever want to get a hold of us, give us a call.
Have a real safe and happy Christmas.
Thank you very much. And well, until next year, this is Community Alert, not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster on KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio and newspress.com. Thank you for listening. The news is next.
This has been Community Alert, not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, and sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Technical support for Community Alert provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. Community Alert, not if, but when. On KZSB AM 1290, your News Press radio station.